Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Mike and Scott in for Marty Moskowain. In the opening chapter of her new book, The Richer Sex, Liza Mundy describes a Detroit family with six adult children. Five of them live in households supported by female breadwinners. They were raised by a stay-at-home mom and an auto engineer breadwinner dad. This is what Liza Mundy calls the flip, and she predicts that within a generation, more households will be supported by women than by men. Liza Mundy joins us from the studios of NPR in Washington. She is a journalist and an author. Liza, thank you so much for being on Radio Times.
Hi, Mike, and thank you so much for having me.
Now, Liza, what has been facilitating the flip, women's economic rise above men? It's a relatively recent development. So what have been the major changes in the past 40 years?
Yes, there's been a convergence of trends. For one thing, we now know that women outnumber men in colleges and universities and are starting to see a payoff to their education. It has traditionally been true that a woman with a college education didn't earn as much as a man with a college education. And while that's still true, the gap is narrowing. So women are you know, getting better educated and more educated than men. They also take the majority of master's and doctorate degrees. At the same time that our economy is changing to favor college-educated workers, and we saw this in the recession, obviously, where manufacturing and construction took such a heavy hit and men lost so many more jobs than women. And this, this is part of a long-term trend, a change in our economy, moving away somewhat from an industrial manufacturing economy in which a man with a high school education really could expect a high-paying job in American industry. We're moving into what they call a knowledge economy, where it's much more important to have a college education or to have high-level training and really necessary. And at the same time, women are starting to benefit from the real strides that have been made in terms of equity and opportunity of the past 30 or 40 years. I mean, there's still discrimination in the workplace. There is still a gender wage gap, but things are getting better.
And Liza, I want to hit you. You hit pretty much on every point that we want to cover in the hour, so we'll get into more detail. But I wanted to ask you, if you had to pick a starting point for this flip, the start of the flip revolution, so to speak, where would you put it? Is it beginning with World War II or the time thereafter when the pill came on the market? What are some of those time factors that made this happen?
Boy, that is a great question. Let's see. I think I would put it in the late 1970s. Mm-hmm. And there's an economist, Claudia Golden, who has shown that this was a real watershed for women in terms of thinking about their futures and their careers. And in the late 1970s, young women asked how they envisioned their lives were much more likely to say that they envisioned a future in which they would be in the workforce. And women began, flocking to college campuses, which were opening up to them in the 1970s. I mean, I went to a college in the 1980s that had been closed to women. I think I was part of they celebrated the 10-year anniversary of coeducation when I was on campus. So, and the pill did have to do with that. Interestingly, economists have also shown that when the pill came on the landscape and contraception became more reliable and women understood that they could have a career that was less likely to be interrupted by an unintended pregnancy, they responded to that economic incentive and they began preparing themselves for professional careers. And it really changed the way women thought about their futures. So we know that women were in a minority on campuses in the 1970s. They achieved parity in the 1980s, and then they began outpacing men and have continued outpacing men.
And I want to talk about the why of that in a minute, but I want to give out the phone number. 1-888-477-9499 is that number if you want to join our conversation with Liza Mundy. Her new book is The Richer Sex. Maybe you are the breadwinner in your relationship. To our female listeners, or maybe to our male listeners, you are married to a female breadwinner. And Liza, you've mentioned that women are overtaking men in terms of the college education. Any thoughts and research as to why?
Yeah, a number of reasons. I mean, one of the reasons that men outnumbered women in the 1950s and 60s, you know, first of all, the GI Bill made it possible for middle-class men to get a college education, but, you know, didn't offer the same incentive to women. And then economists have shown that the Vietnam War was another incentive for men to go to college because of a draft deferment. So there were forces sort of in the middle of the last century that were really propelling men into college. And then those kind of abated. As I said, campuses opened up to women, and they had more of an economic incentive to prepare themselves for careers. There's also pretty persuasive research that shows that, you know, for girls and for young women, school is, not to say that it's easier, but just that it is generally easier for girls to focus in school. Girls tend to get better grades in school. They tend to like school more and to do their homework. And so girls graduate from high school at greater rates and go on to college at higher rates than men do. But interestingly, there's also research that shows that parents may be encouraging girls to go to college and not encouraging boys. The Pew Research Center did a really interesting study which found that parents are more likely to pay for a college education for a daughter than for a son. And that is a flip, because parents used to invest their resources in boys' education. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. Are colleges trying to keep the numbers even? Do they have quotas for female and male attendees? How does that work?
Yeah, some colleges have admitted that they have quotas, you know, that they'll give a preference to boys these days. But other colleges, for example, I spent time in Deep South Texas at the University of Texas Pan American, which has a high Hispanic population. And this is also a community where girls are outpacing boys at an even higher rate academically than the national rate. And they, you know, they understand that boys feel a lot of pressure to start earning. And, you know, families place a lot of pressure on boys to get out in the workforce and start earning. So the university, for example, tries to offer boys jobs on campus so that, you know, it'll keep them on campus. They understand that once they take a job out in the community, their attachment to the university wanes, and you know, they can drop out of the system. So they find ways to just try and keep young men attached to the university.
And Liza, I do want to ask you, the flip, this women's economic rise above men that you talk about, does this cut across different ethnic and racial groups in the U.S.? How about different socioeconomic groups?
For sure it does. I mean, this is a situation that's very familiar to African-American women who have been, you know, really in the vanguard of female breadwinning. And there's an interesting history here that I learned that even back as far as the 1950s, African-American women were more likely to go to college than men. Because if you were a black man and you went to college, there was so much discrimination in the white-collar workforce that you weren't going to get a good economic payoff to that degree. But maybe you could get a reasonably high-paying job in sort of, you know, a blue-collar field. But that wasn't available to women. And so women did get an economic payoff to a college degree because, you know, African American women face so much discrimination in the workforce that if they got a college education, you know, maybe they could be teachers, so they really could better their prospects. So there's always been this disparity. And what has happened in the economy, obviously, African American men have suffered even more than men of other ethnicities in the recession and in the changing economy. And so women have experienced breadwinning in the black community for longer, and also, as I said, in the Hispanic community, it's really interesting because women are getting better educated than men. And I spent a lot of time in this community, you know, where there is still a tradition of machismo and still a tradition of male providership, to talk about how this plays out among relationships. And I found that it was pervasive. As you said, I found this family in Michigan, you know, middle class white family, grew up with a breadwinning dad, and you know, the flip was profound in that family. It's happening in cities. It used to be a phenomenon mostly among the poor, women who had husbands, you know, who were unemployable or couldn't find a job, and women who themselves faced discrimination and couldn't get a high-paying job. But now it's a phenomenon that's taking place really at all levels.
I want to get some more numbers from you. I mentioned a few in the very opening of the show, but you say the flip will really take place within the next generation, that women will overtake men as breadwinners and economically speaking. So where are we now? How many women are in the workforce full time? Which professions do they dominate? And why is that important in terms of, you know, the flip being completed in the next generation?
Right. So what we know, for example, among mothers, 71% of mothers are in the workforce. So it's really high. And you know, about the same percentage of working age wives are in the workforce. Might be a little lower than that. But what we know is that 40% of working women out-earn their husbands, almost 40%. And so that it's interesting that the government tracks that statistic. They have a table for wives out-earning husbands. They don't have a table for the opposite situation. And they started tracking it in the 1980s when it was about 23% of working wives. And if you look at that table, you can see a steady rise. It stagnated a little bit in the 1990s, and then it really began picking up at about 2000, 2001, jumping about a percentage point every year. So it predates the recession, you know, a spike in working wives out-earning their husbands. So I know this is a crude way to make a projection, but if you just plot a chart and you plot that rise and you keep the line going, then you would see that in about 2030, the line would go above 50% and you would have more than half of working wives out earning their husbands.
But the wage gap is still there.
Yeah.
Where are we now with the wage gap?
Right. So how does that work? I know. So the wage gap, the government puts it at about 81, women making 81 cents on a man's dollar. And that is all full-time workers, median wage in all professions. So if you still have women clustered in slightly lower paying professions or working slightly less per week, that can account for part of the wage gap. The fact that among men in the sort of senior ages, like in the you know, age group of the 50s, it's still going to be more men. So among higher paid older workers, you'd still have a preponderance of men, and women, you know, would be larger numbers in the younger age groups. And so, you know, we could potentially expect as women move up in terms of age and seniority for the gap to go away. But economists have shown that there's still a part of the wage gap that is what they call unexplained, that is likely due to discrimination.
I was just
going to also say, though, that the younger the age groups, the less the wage gap, and that there was a really interesting study that came out 2 years ago by a company called Reach Advisors that found that in most American cities now, young women under 30 who don't have children out-earn their male peers. So we have this generation right now that's kind of supercharged young women who are really poised to change this and to close that gap.
And we're coming up on a break in just a few seconds, but what about leadership roles? When I look at CEOs at big companies or when I look at their board meetings, I see men everywhere I look. Is that changing?
Sure. Although there was a recent list of, I guess, the Fortune 500, and there was the highest number of women CEOs ever. And the editor who compiled that list said, you know, that there is sort of one level beneath CEO. There is a really critical mass of women who, again, are poised to improve that number and to change that proportion in the years to come.
That is Liza Mundy. Her new book is The Richer Sex, How the Majority of Female Breadwinners is Transforming Sex, Love, and Family. And we'll get to some of those issues of love and family in just a moment. Give us a call if you want to join the conversation on Female Breadwinners, 1-888-477-9499. We'll be back after a short break. You're listening to Radio Times.
The University of Pennsylvania supports WHYY. Do your drinking habits cause problems in your personal or professional life? Do you drink to cope with stress? These may be signs of alcohol dependence. UPenn is conducting a research study using naltrexone, an FDA-approved medication for use in treating alcoholism. If you are 18 or older, have an alcohol problem, and want to reduce your drinking, you may qualify for the study. Details at 215-222-3200, extension 170. 215-222-3200, extension 170.
I'm Marty Moscowain.
I'm Terry Gross.
And I'm Dave Davies. Help WHYY celebrate 25 years of Radio Times and Fresh Air at a special live event.
Dave will ask the questions. Marty and I will have to answer them at the Suzanne Roberts Theater in Philadelphia.
It all happens Monday, June 4th at 7, and you can reserve your tickets at whyy.org/member experience.
Celebrate 25 years of public media's best, Radio Times and Fresh Air.
The Philadelphia Speaker Series, presented by Widener University, offers a season of diverse ideas, world perspectives, and thought-provoking conversation, featuring Erskine Bowles of the Simpson-Bowles Commission, former President of Mexico Vicente Fox, Miracle in the Andes survivor Nando Parrado, plus a special guest speaker you won't want to miss. Information on the complete lineup of speakers at PhiladelphiaSpeakerSeries.org. Sponsored by WHYY.
And welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mike and Scott in for Marty Moskowain, and we're talking about female breadwinners with journalist and author Liza Mundy, and her new book is The Richer Sex. And Liza, I have to share with you and our listeners that I'm also a female breadwinner and that both of my sisters are the breadwinners in their families. And that didn't really occur to me until I was reading your book. And then I thought, oh, right, that's kind of like my family. So what drew you to this topic? What were you working on that got you interested?
You know, I'll answer that, but let me just say that I think it's really good that you said that, because women are often reluctant to say that they are the breadwinner, and some, you know, married women sometimes worry it will stigmatize their husbands. But I think it's really important for workplaces to understand that women are breadwinners and that women are supporting families and households. And I think that as workplaces understand this, that will also help to change the gender wage gap and the way that women are regarded.
I did ask my husband's permission to,
to
say this.
Right.
So how did you get the idea for the book?
So to answer that, I've written about gender and family issues over the years, and really became intrigued when I began reading stories about women outnumbering men on college campuses, because my experience had been so different. And I wondered, you know, what that felt like for the women on campus, and then how it would affect their lives as they unfold. Because we do now have this generation of young women who outnumber men, you know, women with college degrees outnumber young men with college degrees. So if every young woman, college graduate, wanted to marry a male college graduate, you know, she couldn't. There's a shortage. So, you know, what is that like, and how does that transform dating? And I was talking to my editor at Simon & Schuster, Priscilla Paynton, who is an excellent, excellent spotter of trends. And she was seeing a lot of women in relationships out-earning their husbands. And, you know, we felt like, at the risk of a cliche, that there was maybe a tipping point phenomenon going on. And then when I started looking in the government data and saw that, you know, close to 40% statistic, it really seemed worth investigating.
Now, one of the criticisms of your book has been that you are maybe too, depending on which side you're standing or looking from, too optimistic when
Sure.
it comes to women's situations in the workforce and where the wages will be going and where opportunities will be going. What do you make of that criticism?
Yeah, either that I'm too optimistic in terms of women's wages, or that I'm too optimistic in arguing that this could actually work out well. Any number of things could happen. It depends on the way that our economy changes. It depends to a certain point on whether women will accept this role. I mean, you know, I was at a book talk that was introduced by a young woman, and she was alluding to the title, and she said, you know, this is a little bit scary. And I think that young women, you know, looking at the prospect maybe of being the primary earner in their relationship going forward, maybe do find it a little unnerving, and maybe are feeling the same sense of pressure that men have traditionally felt, you know, regarding themselves as the primary provider. Go ahead.
How is the breadwinner role? You just mentioned the woman saying it is scary. Earlier you said some women are very reluctant to say that they are the breadwinner. So how is it changing women's roles on many levels? But let's start in the home. So if they are in a relationship, how is it changing what they are responsible for and do at home?
I think the happiest female breadwinners I interviewed were women who had ceded, to a certain extent, control over the domestic home front. I mean, not entirely, but, you know, were happy and willing for their husbands to be in some cases, running the household. And, I mean, you know, some women are married to men who are basically the secondary earner, and they're both working outside the home. And some women I interviewed had husbands who were basically stay at home or were working at home. And women who really had entrusted their husbands to the running of the household and appreciated what their husbands were doing for them in terms of, you know, running the children to events and running the household and cooking and, you know, providing that domestic support system. A number of women I interviewed, for example, in this Michigan family, realized that the reason they had been able to move up very high in their workplaces, in a couple cases in the auto industry, and have a family was because they had supportive husbands who were willing to take the secondary earner role. And I do believe that this is one ingredient that's going to enable women to break through the glass ceiling and that we need to come to terms with that. I mean, it's hard to prevail and to reach the highest level when you're married to a partner who's trying to do the same thing. You know, that was when I think, you know, mutual appreciation in those Michigan households. Also, the men were very supportive of their wives and really viewed their marriage as a team. And one of the wives said, you know, I got a great bonus at the end of the year. And his view, you know, was that we got a bonus and had a sense, you know, that he knew that he was contributing to her success, which is absolutely the case. So I think, you know, couples that really do view themselves as teams, it's also important for the woman to relinquish control over her earnings. And I was surprised that this can be hard for women. I think traditionally we've thought of our earnings as supplemental, and we've thought of, you know, sort of our pin money or our discretionary money. And women sometimes cling to that and are reluctant to hand over the pay packet, as it were. And I was surprised at the number of women who said, oh, I worry that my husband feels emasculated having to ask me for money. And I thought, well, why is he having to ask you for money? You know, why don't you have an ATM and two and two cards? Yeah. So I thought, you know, it's important if a woman is the provider for her to embrace that role and that mindset.
I want to hear from one of our listeners at 1-888-477-9499. We have Paul joining us from Bryn Mawr, and he brings up an important point. Hi, Paul. You're on Radio Times.
Thanks very much. And I have to say that Ms. Mundy is right on point with so many things. I was a stay-at-home dad for 25 years with a high-earning, brilliant wife. And I did the whole gamut, cooking, laundry, running the kids to soccer practice, and lived in a world populated by almost entirely by women and children. And it's been a great life. But one thing that always puzzled me watching this social change is that, well, our ideas of sex roles are really guided by like a million years of evolution. And on top of that, there's thousands of years of cultural history, tradition, and all the sex role cues in literature and even language. And I'm wondering, watching these changes in the economy and different economic roles, is how long until women start looking at men who have great child-caring potential with the same attraction that they might look at a guy with a big bankroll or buff abs, you know, something like that. It's just there's like this these inhibiting factors, don't you think?
Good question, Paul. Liza, what do you? I mean, a lot of women obviously see men who have those qualities as attractive already, right, Liza?
Definitely. Yeah, he raised so many important issues. I mean, we could talk about evolutionary psychology and the idea that, you know, women are hardwired to want a man who is a provider, which is a controversial theory. But yeah, definitely women want men who are more domestically competent and nurturing than women might have, you know, in the 1950s or 60s, for sure. And the young, high-earning women that I interviewed, you know, were delaying marital commitment in part because they were looking around for men who would be partners who would pitch in. But there is an inconsistency, I think, in women's viewpoints. When I would ask college-educated women, you know, would you marry a guy who didn't go to college? They were skeptical of this. They were skeptical, and they said, you know, I need to marry a man I can admire. I need to marry a man who's always improving himself. I need to marry a man I can talk to. I'm afraid if he didn't go to college, I couldn't talk to him. So even as they want men who are domestically competent and cooking and nurturing, they do seem to still have this expectation that he will also somehow be as sort of fully charged charged and high-powered as they are. And again, I mean, one really happy couple I interviewed was a young woman who was a law student in Vermont from a working-class background, married a guy who's a carpenter, and he's very, very supportive of her career and is working to put her through law school and also, you know, very domestically competent and at home. And she had really embraced that relationship and appreciated all that he had to offer her. She really had a completely different view, you know, of what a mate should be able to provide. And she understood that he was facilitating her career, which she very much wanted, and making it possible. So we do seem to be in this transitional period where... I mean, we get, you know, get back to the old question of what women want.
So well, we can't answer that on today's show, that's for sure. So, Liza, let me ask you, though. We often talk about this from the women's perspective, but I wonder about the men's perspective. Paul was talking about his life, raising his children, that he seemed to have enjoyed thoroughly those years. And I'm wondering, are men discussing this as a great opportunity to spend time with their kids, to be flexible? Because I'm thinking about my grandfather, who really did not know his children until they were grown-ups, really. My father, who was an excellent father, but was rarely home. So he didn't have that choice. Or probably he might have, but at that time it would have been thought of as revolutionary, really. So are men talking about this as an opportunity to be with kids and to do what they want to do?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I don't know how much men are talking about it among themselves, but definitely men are seeing that. And again, to get back to this Michigan family, you know, three of those husbands had the patriarch, the Ford auto engineer, who's now the grandfather, you know, he says freely that I worked to support these six kids. I worked overtime all the time. I never saw them when they were growing up. They have great relationships now, but he tells younger men, don't live that way. You know, don't do that. You need to enjoy your children when they're little. And all of the male siblings now, you know, reacted to that. They said, you know, I love my dad, but I want to be a different kind of father, and I want to be around for my children and experience them when they're young. And they were all in workplaces that were very unforgiving of working fathers who wanted to actively parent. And so a number of those men left their workplaces because they just didn't think that they could have a career and, you know, be involved fathers. Interestingly, you know, they were feeling a lot of work-life conflict, and they chose life, you could say. So I think, you know, and the studies show that certainly men increasingly understand that it is an advantage to marry a woman with good earning prospects, with a good education and good earning prospects. When men name the traits that are desirable to them in a mate, domestic skills has plummeted, virginity has plummeted, and financial prospects has risen as a trait that they, you know, are interested in a woman. So I think women don't necessarily understand that. You know, women have been led to think that if you get too educated or too successful, you'll be alone and lonely for the rest of your life.
I want to get to that issue in a moment, Liza, but we have Tim joining us from Hillsborough, and he brings up this work-life balance. Tim, thank you so much. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, good morning. I'd just like to say it's an interesting dynamic, but my first comment is that I feel, and I felt this way for a long time, women should be paid the same amount as men for doing the same work. And it's hard to believe in 2012 that that's not totally the case. But aside from that, I would love to have had my wife go out and work. You know, I would love to have her been the breadwinner. Unfortunately, that's not the case. And it was an interesting comment you made earlier talking about how women were kind of intimidated about that fact that they would be the breadwinner. Welcome to my world. I mean, that's how it's always been for men. And,
sure.
I would love to have had a woman who could have worked outside the house.
And Tim, did you have that discussion with your wife, or did you just have the better job? What you said?
I'm an unusual case. I have a son that is disabled, and simply because of that reason, we chose to have my wife stay at home to take care of him. And that's just been the realities of my situation. But I still wish that my wife could have been able to work. It would have been nicer financially, but it would have also been better for her as well. My son is 21 now, my disabled son, and he goes out and works every day in a program. And my wife is now trying to get back into school, and hopefully, you know, she'll be able to find a job. But again, the clock is ticking. I'm 53. She's 54. We've kind of missed our opportunity. But I think it's great that women get out and work in the workforce. And if they can do it, great. If they choose not to, that's good. If they choose to, that's even better.
Tim, thank you so much for that call. That brings up a really interesting point. How do couples have these conversations? I guess it becomes really important when children enter the picture. So,
yes, it does. Or even before that. I mean, it is really interesting. Just as the caller said, I mean, women are experiencing the pressure of being the breadwinner, it just as men did in the 1950s and 60s and before that. And I interviewed a young woman who is a PhD student in engineering in Georgia and was dating a guy who was in the same graduate program but was feeling a little more discouraged than she was. And she had had some great summer internships and had really great job prospects. And he was saying to her, you know, they were talking about who would be, you know, the leading spouse and who would be the trailing spouse if they got married. And he said, you know, I'll move for you. I'll facilitate your career. And I would argue that this is very important for women as workers to have male partners who will potentially move for them. It will, you know, women will be looked differently in the workplace, you know, when that happens. But she was kind of struggling with that because she knows she wants to have children. She wants to be able to spend time with them. And she said, you know, getting boxed in as the primary earner sounds to me like a lot more work and a lot less play. So, as your caller said, you know, welcome to the world that men have known.
Yeah, be careful and, what you wish for, I guess.
But, you know, I also interviewed women who maybe whose husbands were unable to find work in the recession. One young woman out in San Francisco, another engineer, and her well-educated husband was thrown out of work. And she began working even harder. When she thought of herself as the breadwinner, she began working even harder, traveling more, volunteering for assignments. And she found that her performance evaluations were getting better and better and better. So the pressure of breadwinning was pushing her in the workforce to a new level, which is kind of interesting.
And Liza, we have about a minute left before we go to break, but we've been talking about marriage. How is this impacting women's choices in general when it comes to planning their lives, their new opportunities for wage earning professional positions? Is marriage as important as it was, and how is this impacting their decisions in general?
Yeah, great question. Marriage not as important as it was, I think, for many women. Or, you know, women are, particularly in the working class, women are looking out and seeing a pool of men whose prospects have declined in the changing economy and saying, you know what, I can support myself, I can support a child, but I don't want to support another dependent. So women are making the decision to be single moms. And I interviewed a number of these women, and they just didn't feel like their partners, you know, could literally bring enough to the table. So that is one phenomenon that I think probably ultimately we want to address, because those children are, I think, going to grow up at a disadvantage. But we also see women able to leave relationships. There's something that economists call the independence effect, which is when a woman has significant economic resources, she can leave an unhappy relationship, and she will. So, you know, I interviewed a number of women who had made choices to be single, would maybe ultimately like to be in committed relationships, but had had boyfriends or partners who weren't dealing well with their success, so they just left them. And, you know, and they were pretty happy about that. And they were spending a lot of time with other women. So, you know, look around next time you're at a restaurant and see how many tables of women there are going out together, sort of enjoying the interim period. We're certainly seeing a lot of single living. We know that.
And did you see any impact on same-sex relationships? I don't know if that was something you looked at for the book. And
yeah,
we are really coming up on a break.
Yeah,
I'm sorry.
Yeah, so we could talk about that maybe a little later. Same-sex relationships are a model for all of us going forward, because they are more likely to be willing to marry, you know, outside traditional boundaries, outside educational boundaries, outside racial boundaries, outside class boundaries. And this is something I think that heterosexual couples are going to need to look at going forward.
That is Liza Mundy. Her new book is The Richer Sex, and we're talking about female breadwinners and wage earning in America. We'll talk more after a break. You can join the conversation at 1-888-477-9499. Again, that's 1-888-477-9499. We'll take more of your calls after our break. You're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY, Lincoln, introducing the new 2013 Lincoln MKS with organically tanned leather from Scotland, Prussian burl wood, French seams, and curve control. Lincoln, now it gets interesting.
The Garden State Wine Growers Association supports WHYY and presents their annual Mother's Day Wine Trail May 12th and 13th. Wineries will host a variety of events designed to treat mom to a memorable day within the confines of New Jersey's vineyards. The Wine Trail will feature cooking demonstrations, dessert pairings, music, entertainment, and complimentary samplings. To plan a wine trail visit, NewJerseyWines.com.
Hey everybody, Jad here. I wanted to let you know that Radiolab is coming soon to Philadelphia for a live show. We're calling it In the Dark, and it's all about darkness and light, seeing, believing. It's going to be a super fun night because we've got the comedian Dimitri Martin coming with us, the singer-songwriter Tao Nguyen, and the amazing dance troupe Palabolas. They'll all be there. We'll be there June 29th at the Academy of Music. You can get tickets at radiolab.org.
Programming is supported by 21st Century Cyber Charter School, providing public online education for grades 6 through 12, utilizing the latest information and communication technology. More information at 21stcenturycyber.org.
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mike and Scott in for Marty Moskowain. We're talking with Liza Mundy. Her new book is The Richer Sex, How the New Majority of Female Breadwinners is Transforming Sex, Love, and Family. Mundy was a staff writer at the Washington Post for more than 10 years, and she's a regular contributor to Slate and has written several other books. And we're taking your calls at 1-888-477-9499. Let's start with Linda. Hi, Linda. You're on Radio Times.
Oh, hi. Hi, friends. How are you? Thank you for this program. I'm a 58-year-old surgeon, and I have contact with a lot of the residents who are coming through. I work for a very large regional hospital. And when I meet a young woman who is a resident who is married, I say to her, I always have to ask the question, what kind of husband do you have? How did you do it? Because it was very difficult when I was coming through. And it, one of your callers mentioned that women will be looking for a particular type of partner, and it is happening because absolutely 100% of the time of the young women I've asked, maybe 12 so far this year, that they are looking for men who have more of a stay-at-home nature or work from home, or just wish to, you know, are very comfortable in the support position. And most of them have married men who maybe even haven't graduated college. We, in my generation, would have considered that, I don't know, marrying down or something like that. You know, as you were speaking about going, marrying somebody of a lower educational level. But these women are happy, and I'm like, oh, you are so lucky, because when I was going through it in the 80s, I had several serious relationships that just fizzled out when it got to, okay, I'm going to such and such a hospital now, and they would not follow me. They would not give up their career path.
And Linda,
so things are changing. I'm so happy about it.
Linda,
do
you feel that you had to choose your career over having a relationship because you didn't find a person who was willing to kind of work with you around your career?
Yes, I did. And there were several times where I almost gave up on medicine to follow my heart, but I really felt the calling. I really felt it from in every bit of my heart. And I am married now, but I am married late in life, and consequently I sacrificed my childbearing years. So I have a great marriage, but we do not have children. So yes, I did.
And do you feel, when you're looking at these younger women, sometimes I just can't believe how fortunate I am as a woman to have been born when I was born. Is there a tinge of jealousy, or is it all goodwill and gladness when you see these young women who have a lot more choices than you did even, you know, a few years back or seemingly so?
I do feel jealous, and I tell them that. I said, I'm jealous of you, but in a good way. Because, and I try to make them understand how really lucky they are. How, and they have been very receptive. Because I want to keep telling the story that it wasn't like that 10 years ago. It wasn't like that 20 years ago. So yeah, I am a little jealous of them. I'm happy for them. I'm happy for them, and I'm so glad things are changing. And they're smart enough to be assertive enough to say, this is who I am, and to look for who they need. which maybe I didn't know how to do, and there wasn't that much out there.
Linda, thank you so much. Linda, thank you so much for your call and for all that you bring up. Liza, any reaction to what Linda is sharing with us?
Just that's so interesting. I mean, I was in college also in the 1980s, and we sat around our dorm room and wondered, you know, how we could make work-life-family balance work, how we could have kids and jobs. But it never occurred to us that a husband might make his career secondary to ours or move for us or make compromises for us. So I feel like what this observant surgeon has said is an endorsement of an optimistic viewpoint. I mean, that women do understand that they're really going to flourish in their profession. Maybe they do need these supportive secondary earner partners, and the fact that they're seeking them out and that they feel empowered to seek this out is seems to me a really a good thing.
And something I wanted to ask you about, she brings up the field of healthcare, and there are certain fields that are becoming increasingly dominated by women, and you describe something in your book that you call male flight, where men are actively leaving professions. What are those professions, and why are men getting out of them?
Really interesting. I mean, healthcare has traditionally been a woman's field, but, you know, particularly the field of medicine now. I mean, doctors, not simply nurses, but doctors are, you know, that field is becoming increasingly feminized. And there are a number of fields like OBGYN and internal medicine that when you look at physicians under 45, it's a significant majority female. So the profession of veterinary medicine is an interesting example. It has gone from being pretty much all male to being increasingly all female. And veterinary classrooms are full of women now. And people have looked at why. And part of it is because the structure of the profession has changed, and the emergency after-hours work is increasingly handled by standalone facilities. So women can take jobs at regular vet practices and know that, you know, they'll have reasonable, predictable hours and maybe could have, you know, part-time work, and so that'll be conducive to parenthood. But some people have also argued that there's something called gender pollution, that men have a tendency to leave a profession rather quickly or not enter it if it begins to seem majority female.
Yeah, it was interesting. My OBGYN, who happens to be a man, says he has a group for male students who want to get in that field. It almost kind of sounded to me like a support group for the male students because they're five of them in a huge class. So there are certain fields where men now must feel completely outnumbered.
Right. And similarly, I was talking to my regular doctor, my internist, and she is in Washington. She said, you know, we have this sort of networking support group for women doctors. And she said, I'm not really sure why we even have it anymore. I'm not really sure that we need it. Yeah.
So going forward, what do successful employers need to know about these changing dynamics, and what do they need to maybe change?
Well, that is a really good question. The pay scale, you know, as we talked about, they need to understand that women are breadwinners and that households depend on this money. And, you know, I do think that as employers understand that women are married to supportive spouses, that they will look at women differently and promote them, you know, if that's what the woman wants, to positions of even greater responsibility and leadership. I mean, it's interesting. Back in the 1930s, 40s, and even 50s, married men and fathers were explicitly paid more. It was called the marriage premium or the fatherhood premium because employers realized that they were breadwinners and that they had felt that they had a responsibility to support families. And this is one of the reasons why working women were really stigmatized, particularly in the Depression. You know, the idea that they were taking men's jobs, that men were the natural breadwinners, etc. So this was the kind of the ruling mindset. And employers need to understand that, you know, that women increasingly are occupying that role.
Let's take another call. We have Maureen joining us from Mayfair at 1-888-477-9499. Hi, Maureen. You're on Radio Times.
Hello. Is it me?
Yes, I think. I'm sorry. It said Maureen on my
screen. I'm sorry. My name's Rob. I was in a sort of ironic situation where I came down to Philadelphia with my partner and to be a house husband. And you know, they just had gotten their master's and went to be a teacher, and then after 3 years got fed up with being the teacher, you know, being the breadwinner. And so, they wanted to stop working, so then, you know, I started working doubles. But, you know, and I'm telling you, being the person at home is, it was very difficult for me. I mean, it wasn't easy. So it's, you know, one of those unsung jobs. But, you know, it was very strange to see someone who, you know, went down to make more money than either of us had ever made before get fed up with being the breadwinner. And, you know, there was nothing to do but, you know, go ahead and try and make as much money as I could, you know, at a much, you know, lower pay rate, but
yeah. Anyway. Let me thank you for your call, and I think one of the issues that comes up here is that the roles are also not as cut and dry as they used to be. So there could be periods
right.
where the one partner is the breadwinner and then another period the other one takes over. So that's also an option for a lot of couples, correct, Liza?
Yes, it is. And, you know, that probably would be the ideal situation going forward, although it does sound as though maybe in this situation there was a fair amount of maybe dissatisfaction. And it is true now that everything, right, has to be a negotiation. I mean, there aren't kind of accepted roles. So under ideal circumstances, it's a productive conversation. And under less than ideal circumstances, it could be an argument. And in fact, I interviewed couples where they were kind of arguing over which one got to be, you know, the secondary earner with more freedom, able to do sort of a more creative entrepreneurial role, and which one had to be the breadwinner yoked to the office job.
Mm-hmm.
So that, you know, it can be a source of conflict like anything else. But I think, you know, I think for many couples, it will happen and maybe would be ideal that you could kind of trade back and forth. And if you have children, you know, when the children are young, maybe one person would be the part-time or secondary worker and then would maybe be able to sort of ramp it back up later on and that you could trade back and forth and support each other. Although, you know, some workplaces want, you know, with married couples, I interviewed some women who had interned at an oil company that likes to have married couples, and they like them to identify early on who's going to be the primary spouse and who's going to be the trailing spouse.
Hmm. Let's bring in Maureen because we almost had her on the phone. So let's go to Maureen from Mayfair joining us. Hi, Maureen. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. How are you? Thanks so much for letting me call in. This is a topic near and dear to my heart. My mother was a single mom. My father left when we were kids. And she had to raise us and work and, you know, to support us. And something she said all the time to my sister and I was, always be able to take care of yourself. Don't ever depend on a man. I mean, that was like our mantra. I had no idea how mm-hmm. much it affected me until I became a working mom. And I wonder if, you know, the people my age, I'm 43, who grew up in the 70s and 80s, you know, women like me with divorced parents, if they're the same, if they always had that, geez, what happened to my mom, I can't have happened to me, you know?
Yeah.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
I'm wondering, Liza, how that generation of women impacted their children, maybe not just divorced or single moms, but all moms who maybe felt like they missed out on a career or had to make a choice between career and family and what they taught their daughters.
I have verbatim quotes in my book from, you know, that say that exactly that. Women said, I saw what my mom went through and I don't want to go through that. I mean, young women saw that they had moms who maybe couldn't leave unhappy marriages because they didn't have any earning potential and so they suffered in marriage because they didn't feel that they could leave. Women also saw moms who were disadvantaged when they did leave marriages because they didn't have the earning potential and, of course, faced a lot of wage discrimination. And so they, you know, they suffered after divorce economically. And I interviewed so many young women for whom this was an absolute driving mantra, and this is one reason why women are going to college, because they had never been able to get those really high-paying industrial jobs with just a high school degree. I mean, women know that in order to get a decent job, they have to go to college, and so they're doing it with with the absolute conviction, I've got to be able to secure my future. I can't depend on a guy. I must be able to support myself.
How are the breadwinning moms raising their kids? What are some of the lessons that they are imparting on their daughters now?
Yeah, I think it's really interesting. I mean, breadwinning women wonder how this is going to impact their children.
Mm-hmm.
And I did interview some adult children of breadwinning moms. And they talked about, you know, in families that were middle class or well off, where this had worked out well and where it had been a choice, the women I talked to, the daughters, said, you know, I loved having my dad around when I was growing up. It was so important to me. You know, he braided my hair or he made me breakfast or he took me to school and I felt so special. He was the only dad had who was around. All the PTA moms were in love with him, and they really felt, you know, very close to their fathers and very happy. And they really felt admiring of their moms. I mean, we know that working mothers spend more time with their children today than stay-at-home moms did like 40 years ago. Yeah. So it's not like these kids are not seeing their mothers. Their mothers are working really hard to make sure that they're present and attentive when they're home. So I think, you know, that works out really well. And boys and girls alike grow up with an understanding that there are, you know, a variety of choices now. I think where it's harder on children is where poorer and working class women are just deciding to go it alone as single moms, saying, you know, there's not a satisfactory pool out there of productive mates, so I'm going to support my child. And studies show that if a father doesn't live with his children and if he can't provide economically, he's more likely to lose touch with them and not see them. So, you know, that those children, I think, are growing up at a disadvantage.
And Liza, we are coming up toward the end of our show, but you do bring up in the book something I found interesting, which is how households, how the look of houses or kitchens will change with this new species of domesticated man entering into the realm. So what are some trends that you foresee? You foresee the end of the man cave, for example.
Right, because the whole house will be a man cave, yes. And, you know, cooking
a good-looking one.
Right, cooking is a very masculine activity now, and this was not true when I was growing up. My dad didn't feel like he could cook, but he does now. And I think there's been this other subtle flip that you see women, as I said, just out in restaurants, out in public spaces, you know, socializing, and you see men being very happy at home, in part because we've got all these great appliances now. And I mean, I have a close friend whose wife is the working spouse, and he's a writer, and he's got two grills and a smoker and, you know, all these really sort of manly appliances, you know, blow torches now for the creme brulee. And as one celebrity chef put it, you know, the kitchen is the new garage. So you can bring all the tools out of the garage and put them in the kitchen. So homes are becoming much, much more masculine.
And just very briefly, do you see a lot of negotiation as we go forward where the roles are not clearly defined? People will have to kind of have this constant conversation about who does what and when and why. So do
yes.
you see negotiation?
Yes. Yes. Yeah. And you know, and ideally it's a conversation and a pleasant, productive negotiation. And yeah, I mean, one mom says we made this decision and then we have never looked back. And it has been great.
That is Liza Mundy. Thank you so much for joining us today, Liza. It was wonderful to talk to you. She has written a new book called The Richer Sex, How the New Majority of Female Breadwinners is Transforming Sex, Love and Family. Thank you so much for joining us on Radio Times today.
Thank you, Maiken.
And thanks to all of our callers for weighing in. You've been listening to Radio Times. I'm Maiken Scott in for Marty Moskowain.